This week in Retronauts, it's a retirement party. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Retronauts Micro. That's right, Micro. This is a mini episode, even though it's kind of structured like a real episode. I am Jeremy Parrish, and with me this week to celebrate retirement is
Chris Kohler, features editor of Kotaku.
Ooh, that sounds weird.
That is
You've never
new.
Done that before.
I know, that's really weird.
Still getting used to that, huh?
Yep.
All right. You?
Jose Otero, editor at IGN.
Okay, that's the same.
Uh-huh. Hey, I'm retiring.
I'm Bob Takeda on me, Mackie.
What?
Take on me.
Oh, my goodness.
There we go.
You were holding this.
I was writing that in the bathroom, so you're welcome.
That was what you were doing. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Brainstorming.
Yes. So Bob gave away the big surprise.
Hey, it's in the title of the episode. People know.
But sometimes people just like click blindly on iTunes.
They do.
Just download
yeah,
a thing.
I do. I'm just like, audio, give me.
What is this? Old video games. Forget that.
This episode's standout game is OutRun, a driving simulator that has inspired countless gamers to dream of cruising down the roads of Europe. Top down, wind in their hair, a good-looking blonde companion in the passenger seat, breezy Calypso tunes playing on the radio. Now, I can't help you with the European road trip part or the attractive blonde riding shotgun, but I can at least offer a helpful pointer in getting set up with that dream car. That secret is TrueCar. With TrueCar, you get real pricing on actual inventory. Not numbers made up by TrueCar, but pricing from an actual dealer. One of 13,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. This is a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. TrueCar allows you to find the exact vehicle you want, whether new or used, working directly with a TrueCar certified dealer. And thanks to the TrueCar pricing curve, you can see what others in your area have paid for the same vehicle you're looking for. So not only will you be looking at the cars that are actually available to you, but you'll also have the confidence of knowing a fair price. That's why on average, TrueCar users have saved more than $3,000 off the MSRP of their dream car across more than 3 million vehicles sold. When you're ready to commit to a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Yes, this week we are talking about Genyo Takeda, who is a Nintendo executive and game designer who has been in the industry for a long time, but no more. He recently announced at an investors meeting, I believe,
that which makes
he,
sense.
Yes, he is retiring, and it's kind of a big deal. He's been
it
there
is.
Forever.
Yep.
Is he like the most tenured person at Nintendo now?
He's up there.
Is he the most tenured person in the video games industry now?
Oh, my goodness.
only if Gunpei Yokoi had still been at Nintendo and not died would he be the he would beat Takeda, I think. Was
he came in under under Yokoi.
Yeah.
And yeah, if Hiroshi Yamauchi hadn't died, he'd also be
right.
more tenured.
But I mean, like game
sure.
designers, not
but I mean,
money dudes.
Yamauchi left, and you know, I mean, Gunpei Yokoi actually did. He did not go out of Nintendo in a pine box. He quit.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, 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 right. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
possibly, and if not, don't at me.
Yeah. No, I'm curious to know. Is there someone who has been at Nintendo longer than Takeda?
80-year-old accountant who won't go home.
Well, again, I tell this story a lot, but the first, back in the year 2002 when I waltzed in like a big dumb foreigner right into Nintendo's old playing cards building, there was a little old man in the lobby of the playing cards building that yelled at me to get out. And that dude, he might have been working at Nintendo for a long time.
So he might still be there.
Yeah, but this is custom, right? like, yeah. You're a member of the board of directors. You have to sort of say, okay, I'm retiring and here's my replacement, which they said was the guy under him, Koshioda. Shioda. I may be mispronouncing mm-hmm. that, but that's sort of his partner in arms at Nintendo.
Okay. So why is it a big deal that Genyo Takeda is retiring? Why are we having an episode about a guy retiring?
Star Tropics. I mean, come on. Nintendo's best game.
Punch Out? We're getting warmer?
Well, I think it's just the fact that who else has been in the games industry as long as Genyo Takeda? And he's had his hands on a lot of really big projects, but also, you know, because he has risen in the ranks at Nintendo, he's just been a key figure in one of the biggest games company for True. As long as the games industry has existed. 45 yeah. years. He came to Nintendo in 1972. Uh-huh. That is a long time. So I just feel like this is pretty remarkable and probably deserves to be remarked upon.
For sure. So, let us remark.
Yes. Chris, have you ever interviewed Takeda?
No. And now that he finally left Nintendo, maybe one day I'll get the chance.
Yeah. When did he stop working in actual game design? It's been a while, right?
You're holding the notes.
I want to say he helped maybe – God, I want to say Super Punch-Out, maybe he like oversaw that with his protege, the guy who directed Punch-Out for NES. But he could have been just on some random Wii channel thing or something like that. I mean, I know he directed the first official video game that Nintendo ever made, like for first arcade game, I think.
Yeah, first yes, mechanical EDR game. Race. Yeah. Yeah, it was a mechanical game, right? That was like very, you know, just in Nintendo's practices, just like not the most efficient piece of technology, I would say. Like yeah. it kept breaking down and he had a lot of servicing. It was based on like a weird use of technology and video imaging.
Yeah, and I cracked the books yeah. on Takeda for the Punch-Out episode.
That's
and
right. It was you like, should listen to that, kids.
Oh, thank you. But that's where Punch-Out came from because the video thing was too unreliable. So they're like, let's pretend it's video. And that's sort of how it came into being. But this is Jeremy's episode, so sorry.
No, that's fine. Flesh this out. I didn't like – you know, put down a lot of
okay.
Hard
I was afraid to say these things.
This. No, okay. Go ahead. I mean, I would like for this to be more kind yeah. of like an organic conversation.
I mean, I've said all these things on the Punch-Out episode. That was like 8 months ago. But yeah, EVR Race was Nintendo's first arcade game. It was a video based game using an obsolete format in which you place bets on either cars or horses,
That's
depending
right.
on
Two flavors.
The model or whatever, and it would switch to different video tracks, so it would be randomized. And I don't know if you would actually win money or if it was just you were just choosing for fun. I've seen a picture of the unit, but I don't know actually how it functions.
Yeah, it was based around kind of a similar like technological premise to Wild Gunman, right?
I think
so, yeah. Like the original
yeah.
projection system that would change to different video tracks depending on whether yeah. you shot a dude or he shot you.
I don't know the technological basis for Wild Gunman, but I'm guessing it could be that EVR format, which – was used briefly and then
yeah.
used again.
And if you want to see this thing, like Google it, but it'll show up on beforemario.com. Like they have
oh, yeah,
a bunch
a
of
site.
Like photos of it. It accommodated – EVR Race accommodated 1 to 10 players, which was insane, although the picture they had on the site I think was only 5.
Mm.
But there's just fun facts like that you should totally check out.
Yeah. But he kind of came up pretty quickly through the ranks, I think. And I mean, you know, like a decade after he joined Nintendo, he was running his own division. And I know we've talked about this, but basically once Nintendo started getting into video games and you know, launched their home console, the Famicom, they kind of restructured internally and created divisions. So there were like basically 4 R&D divisions. I think there was always R&D 1, but then, you know, R&D 2 came along and then R&D 3. And then when, you know, after Donkey Kong, Shigeru Miyamoto was given a new division, R&D 4, which eventually became Entertainment Analysis Division, EAD, which
now is
Entertainment
EAD.
Analysis and Development.
Development, that's it.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which now has a different name again because they've restructured
again. Well, they merged everything.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean they re-kind of compiled their internal structure in 2002 or so.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of during the classic era, the NES era, the Super NES era, they worked with these divisions. And, you know, R&D 1 was like Game Boy and portable systems. R&D 2 was the – we don't really talk about R&D 2.
What was R&D 2?
Was R&D 2 his division?
No. He worked Uemura, the guy who created the design of the Famicom.
That's right.
Was R&D 2's head.
Okay.
And then Takeda was put in charge of R&D 3.
What did EAD become? R&D 4 was EAD, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like EAD was R&D 4 name later.
And for our listeners, EAD, Mario and Zelda teams, basically, right?
Yeah.
For the most part.
Basically, it kind of sounds like once a person kind of, you know, proved themselves and became super instrumental in Nintendo's success, they were given their own division. Because you started with Yokoi in R&D1, and he was like the old guard guy who put Nintendo on the map in the first place, we know, with Ultra Hand. And then Uemura came over from, I want to say, Sharp, and helped to design the like the TV consoles that Nintendo launched in 1975. Mm-hmm. Then Takeda was put in charge of R&D3 after, you know, kind of proving his merit with arcade games and stuff. And then Miyamoto was given R&D4 once Donkey Kong exploded. So
that's and R&D2, which I just looked up, this was Uemura's division. Mm-hmm. And this was really more focused on not only like technology, but like system operating software and technical support, mm-hmm. says Wikipedia. So their list of games, which exists, is very short.
Pretty small,
they did Mach Rider and Ice Hockey, and then it's like they did like Sute Hakun, mm-hmm. and then they did all the porting for the Mario Advance games on Game Boy Advance. It's just a very, very small list.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They did the Mario games.
Yeah.
And now that group has become kind of its own group at Nintendo.
It was merged into Nintendo SPD, which was merged into EAD, and I still forget. Is it called EP? What is the new? What is
EPD,
the?
EPD.
Is it
EPD? I think so. Yeah, it's EPD. Yeah. I used to put an extra E on it, but yeah, it's don't know what the acronym said. Yeah,
oh, God, I forgot.
I really missed the pre 2003 Nintendo divisions. I knew them and I knew what they made. Now it's just like
yes. Well, now now the point is they finally eliminated the last vestige of Yamauchi's basically like feudal lord system, mm-hmm. in which all the divisions competed with each other and didn't know what the other divisions were doing and kept technological secrets from each other.
Wow.
And so Nintendo has finally cut all that out, and now there's one hardware development group. Because again, like the portable and the home systems
were separate,
developed by different groups. So they finally eliminated one hardware group, one software group, the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Takeda kind of rose to prominence within this feudal structure and became R&D3's daimyo, more or less.
Yeah, precisely.
So, R&D3 was more software focused than R&D2. Maybe not as quite as R&D or as software focused as, you know, R&D4. Like, I don't think Miyamoto's division ever worked on anything that wasn't just software. Like, that was what they did.
They did not, as a general rule, no, they did not do hardware.
Whereas Takeda's group was kind of mostly focused on software, but sometimes they came up with things that helped make their software better. And that ended up being really instrumental in the success of the NES and really shaped kind of the direction that hardware took outside the US or outside of Japan, where Nintendo had a much tighter leash on software development and especially on licensees. Takeda's group came up with the memory mapper chip scheme, which basically made NES games capable of being interesting and functional and worth playing after 1986 or so, when, you know, the hard limits of the basic NES cartridge capabilities and the basic hardware capabilities of the system itself were sort of, you know, hit the wall.
Hmm. Yeah, and other things he developed, I pulled up my punch out notes as a refresher. I have down here the backup battery, the analog controller on the N64, and he was a key developer of the Wii, which we talked about in our Wii episode.
Yeah, that backup battery was like so important for Zelda, right? Like, could we have gotten Zelda without it?
It would have been a password system, and it would have been terrible.
Yeah, important for just game design in general.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Like being able to save your progress without a password.
That Japan experienced Zelda, and there were load times. You had to like flip over the disc.
It's not that bad, though. It's really not that bad.
Yeah.
I've played all the way through it on Famicom Disk System, and it's not that bad.
It's not as fast, though.
It's not like Simon's Quest, where if you go left from the first town, you have to flip the disk. Or you don't flip the disk, but you have to load.
Yeah.
And then it, like, you know, there's this two werewolves who come at you in the swamp immediately to the left of the first town.
That's right.
And if you get hit by the werewolves who fire projectiles at you as soon as you show up on screen, you'll get hit and fly back off screen into town, and then there's another like 10-second load time. So that's bad. Zelda is not that bad.
Okay, fair
enough. But the battery backup allowed people to plug in their cartridge, press it down, press the power button, and it jumped in, press start. There's a title screen, a save select screen. You press start again and you're playing as opposed to doing all that and then punching in a 64-digit password with ambiguous characters and upper and lowercase letters and
Who can forget numbers. Metroid and the awful font that was chosen.
Metroid wasn't even that bad. I mean, that was a fairly compact
You still got it wrong from time to time.
You did.
Though. It hurt.
But I was thinking more like Fazanadu or something where it's just like that font was bad.
All the serifs?
Passwords were like they were like so long.
Didn't every letter have like 9 serifs on it? So like what am I even looking at here?
Yes, basically. So, you know, people still used passwords because it was cheaper to incorporate a password into your game than to incorporate SRAM and a battery. But, you know, for Nintendo first-party games, it made a lot of sense because they were the ones, you know, holding the purse strings. That was their own manufacturing process. So they were kind of like, yeah, let's just put a battery in here. And it made their games just like you can just jump right in and play. And, you know, with Zelda, that meant, you know, no matter how long you played, no matter how far into the game you'd gotten, you could always just save the game when you were done. You died. Okay. You hit save. You're frustrated and disgusted with the game. You don't want to write down a password. You're depressed because you lost at the 7th dungeon again. So, yeah, it just made the games more playable, more approachable.
You also said the analog stick, right?
For the N64, yeah.
Yeah, no, there's another really important piece of technology. I mean, I feel – although, I mean, was there anything like it before that?
There had been analog controllers, sure.
Yeah. But,
And, you know, the battery backup had been used in pinball machines to save high scores, right? So I mean, it's not like they came out of whole cloth. But
no,
it's like,
but I mean,
the idea of let's apply this. I mean, no, I mean it's no
let's,
less
let's
impressive
put that into
to say
a cartridge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. To say let's put this in every video game cartridge we sell. I mean, that's a smart thing.
Well,
to
that's
do.
Kind of the theme of his career. I mean, even being involved heavily in like the Wii, for example, which was like Nintendo's moment of hey, we're not going to follow where technology's going. Instead, we're going to work on power consumption, make it smaller, make it more efficient, and we're not going to blow the doors off with graphics everyone else is going for.
That's the same thing with Punch-Out. It's like we could make a Laserdisc game, but we'll make a much cheaper version that we don't have to maintain that will have the same effect on people. It's just these cheaper solutions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
never in my life, by the way, have I seen a Punch-Out machine in Japan. I mean, a lot of this is like you don't actually see a lot of old Japanese arcade machines in Japan period, just because, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of room in Japan, so they tend to get rid of a lot of this stuff. But I mean, I really have never, ever seen a Punch-Out in Japan. I'm not saying they didn't release it there. They did. But like just never saw
NCL's one. NCL's hanging on to all of them like everyone else. Too bad.
Well, most of what you see in Japan now are
– they're the standardized –
Yeah, most of what you see in Japan now are
– Astro City, whatever, you know, sit-down cabinets. Yeah, and they put games that would go into those cabinets and they put them in those cabinets. Punch-Out, since it requires the dual monitor setup, doesn't slot easily into, you know, any existing cabinets.
yeah, but even Punch-Out and that dual monitor setup, just the problem to solve being, hey, we have too many monitors left over.
Let's do something.
Please use these for something. Anything.
Yep. Very smart.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
It never fails. You're out enjoying a romantic picnic in the cemetery, just you and the princess, when suddenly a minion of darkness rends the sky, swoops down, and abducts her without warning. Then you're stuck making not one, but two treks through the village of the demon world, equipped with nothing but a suit of armor that explodes at the slightest touch with a hazard and leaves you running around in your underwear. That's the worst. So wouldn't it make sense to make sure you're at least wearing the most comfortable underwear available? That is to say, MeUndies. The softest underwear you'll ever wear. Every pair of MeUndies is sustainably sourced and made from micromodal, a fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. If you're used to buying boring underwear, MeUndies will change everything. MeUndies come in all kinds of colors and patterns, and they release new limited edition patterns each month that always sell out. This month's patterns were designed by legendary 80s clothing brand Cross Colors, with names that live up to their retro design and bright colors. Increased Peace, Ya Dig, and The OG. You need to see them for yourself, and right now you'll save 20% off your first pair and receive free shipping only at MeUndies.com/games. There's a reason MeUndies has sold more than 5 million pairs to date. You'll feel it when you put them on. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. Get 20% off your first pair plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/games. That's MeUndies.com/games. You may not be able to control your jumps in midair, but at least you can outfit yourself with comfortable underwear at MeUndies.com/games.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America.
It was the next day that I found out from my parents what had happened, that my sister was killed.
Each one is called a cold case.
Sometimes you have to look really closely to find the evidence.
Damn it, I killed her.
Damn it, I killed her.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
Garcia is walking into the home of a real monster.
I was nervous. I realized what kind of person I was dealing with.
It's a goosebump moment.
Download new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
For those of us in the Patreon game, it's easy to know what we're worth. Basically, it's whatever you're willing to pay us. But for those of you out there with more traditional jobs, knowing what you should be paid is a different story altogether. So if you don't live off of crowdfunding, Dice, our sponsor for this week's episode, will be incredibly useful to you. By visiting Dice.com or using Dice's mobile app, you can discover what your skills are worth and receive salary estimates based on your specific skill set and location. And if you're looking to earn more, Dice can tell you which skills bring home the most bank. Dice has been connecting tech pros with job opportunities for over 20 years. Now they're a full-blown career hub delivering the tools and resources you need to manage your career. Dice will let you browse over 70,000 tech jobs ranging from software development, UX, and project management, and give you a tremendous amount of insight around the job market about which skills are hot and which ones are cooling off. And with Dice, you can also check out salary reports and tools to fully understand how you stack up. To find out more, visit dice.com/canyouhackit. That's dice.com/canyouhackit. Hack your career with Dice.
Anything go to waste.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the
Nintendo way.
That is the Nintendo way.
It's interesting that, you know, you talked earlier, Chris, about the feudal lord system and how there was a left-hand, right-hand failure to communicate within Nintendo's divisions. But I do think it's interesting that a lot of what Takeda did during the NES era was to make someone else's hardware design more viable.
Mm. Sure.
I mean, besides the battery backup, again, you had the MMC, the memory mapper chips, and those were essential to making the Famicom and NES viable beyond kind of like their basic hardware level, because they allowed basically a paging system where you could – it was kind of like putting multiple game ROMs together.
Mm.
The NES could only look at so much at a time, but you know, this much of a game, like, you know, is a very small amount. You can have Super Mario Brothers in there if you really squeeze, but anything more complex than that, there's just no room. But the memory mapper chips allowed you to have like a page that was the size of Super Mario Brothers, and then you flip the page and there's another game code chunk the size of Super Mario Brothers, and so you just keep adding those and it switches over.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, instead of having a one-page book, you've got a novel basically.
Must have made those programmers really happy, I'll say that.
I'm sure it did. I mean, I think, you know, the Famicom disk system was designed to sort of address that problem, to give people more capacity. But then they came up with a memory mapper chip scheme, and all of a sudden the Famicom disk system wasn't really necessary, and it was also really easy to pirate.
Yeah, so, and the disks had a limited capacity, so it was larger, but as soon as cartridges passed that, right. the disk was behind and they couldn't do anything
right.
to the disks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people were like, why didn't the disk system ever come to the US? Well, that's because by the time it would have made sense to bring it over, mm-hmm. it didn't make sense
They'd already
anymore.
Moved on. Yeah. yeah.
Like cartridges were better, and yep. that's because of the memory mapper system.
It's funny that you talk about these groups working in isolation. That's it explains Star Tropics to me perfectly. It's like this team is making their own Zelda with an arcade sensibility. It's not the Zelda sensibility. So it is a Zelda-ish game, but it's like really punishing and requires like really good reflexes. And I hate it, but I want to love it so much. There's so much about that game I want to love. But
yeah.
it's one of the like two or three games he's directed, maybe four games he's directed.
He's directed four games,
yeah,
as far
like
as I can tell.
Two arcade Punch-Out games, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, and Star Tropics.
Mm. Oh, also pro wrestling.
Oh, pro wrestling?
He worked on that. I think that was kind of a collaborative venture with a company called Try, which eventually became Human Entertainment.
Okay, cool. Yeah. But I feel like he was always rooted in that arcade world with his game design, so I can definitely see that with Star Tropics mm-hmm. for sure. And God, I love that game, but I also hate it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that – I mean one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Takeda is because his games have – more than anyone who I think has ever worked at Nintendo internally, his games have the most sort of like Western mentality, the Western mm-hmm. appeal.
I'm guessing what happened was something along the lines of – Nintendo of America is like, hey, this game will do really well for us in the West. Can we get a game like this? And Nintendo's like, well, Miyamoto's not going to make it, and the other game development division under Yokoi, they're not going to make it. So we're going to give it to R&D 3, and they'll make your game.
Yokoi
for you
likes making things that are Japanese weird, but we want Western weird. So let's give it to Takeda.
Right. Yeah, I mean, basically, like they were just like, okay, yeah, you guys do it. I mean, I'm kind of like, this is my headcanon, but there's probably a reason for that. Everybody else is probably just busy.
Yeah, but kind of one of the weird side effects or interesting side effects is that I think because you know this group did come up with all the memory mapper chips, like some of their games use memory mapper schemes that no other games on NES ever did.
Yeah,
Punch-Out uses a unique chip. It's only used in Punch-Out and Mike Tyson's Punch-Out called the MMC-2, mm-hmm. which allows like I think more and bigger sprites or something like that.
Right.
I can't remember exactly.
Were they big?
That was essentially like they couldn't bring Punch-Out the arcade game over to the NES as is, but I think they looked at it and they said, okay, well, what can we have and what can we lose? Do we need a big Little Mac, you know, character on screen with wireframes? No, it's really not necessary. Do we need a two-monitor thing? No. Do we need big, expressive boxer characters? Yes. And so it was like we need to do that. So if that means it have to have – and maybe they envisioned this chip being used later on down the line.
Yeah.
But again, maybe like the disk system, it was just supplanted technologically very quickly and it was like, oh, there's no reason to ever use this again.
Yeah. I mean they came up with the MMC-3, mm-hmm. which allowed for you know like the score boxes along the screens and non – like two-directional scrolling and things like that. So all of a sudden, yeah, like the MMC-2 – did some cool stuff, but the MMC-3 was you know, the next step and it was much more practical for what people wanted to do with their game.
And it was a generalist sort of thing versus something that's like it gives you big sprites. It's like, okay, well, unless you're going to make a game that has like you know, giant towering characters, you don't really need this.
You mentioned Little Mac and he only exists in the NES version. He's not in the SNES version
Correct.
Or the arcade games, but he's Little Mac because they couldn't make him big.
Right.
So they made him Little Mac and I think that's so ingenious. It's like, oh, he's a little guy. So there you go. That's your explanation.
Well,
it's
like Mario before the Mushroom.
Yeah.
It is. I mean that's the Nintendo way of design the game first and then write the story later based on what you had – what your design restraints were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the other unique mapper chip that Takeda's games used was the MMC-6, which was actually just the MMC-3 plus battery backup. And it wasn't until I started reading about this – you know, this unique chip that – you know, apparently is a little harder to emulate than the standard MMC-3. I was like, well, wait a minute. You couldn't save games on MMC-3s? And I started looking and no MMC-3 game has battery backup. If a game has battery backup, it's MMC-4, which I realize this is like super, you know, minutia, like who really cares? But
this was
interesting because like these mapper technologies – played a big part in kind of the design and capabilities and potential of NES games. And, you know, MMC3 was by far the most popular of the later NES cartridges. Like everything, Super Mario Brothers 3, et cetera, were on MMC3. And I think, you know, maybe Super Mario Brothers 3 didn't have battery backup because the chip didn't exist for it.
Yeah. Until later. It's like – it's funny because if you – the more you start to learn about this stuff, the more you can start to figure out, okay, well, why was this game designed the way it was? Oh, it was literally because of the cost of parts, the availability yeah. of what using this part meant for – you know, you can't have a saved game. You know, so yeah. Yeah. It's really – it's fascinating.
MMC6 was only used in the Star Tropics games, just those right. games. Those
oh, two. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
They're the only games of those style that
again,
can actually use
you know,
battery backup.
He had the direct line to Yamauchi, so literally all they had to do was get him drunk enough to say, okay, you can make a chip and use it on your own games. Like I don't know if they would – I would go so far as to say, oh, and then he never shared it with anybody else. He wanted to keep it to himself. I would doubt that. But to be able to make essentially to say a bespoke chip for these games, especially if the order is coming down from America saying, hey, you know, again, we really think Punch-Out will be a world-smashing success in America, and it was. Or we need a game like Star Tropics that's something that's geared towards the American style of
yeah,
play.
Yeah, I mean, Star Tropics never was released in Japan, nor was its sequel.
No.
So those games must have done – the first game must have done well enough here that they were, you know, justified in creating a sequel to it several years later. They were yeah. like, yeah, that was a hit. Let's make another one.
In
yeah.
terms of the ideas, like why, like did he share these ideas or did he keep them to himself? Like he was working on Star Tropics while everyone else was working on Super Famicom stuff. So it's like, we don't need these chips. We're not going to make any more NES games.
Right.
Like just
right,
do whatever
right.
you want.
So would you then say he was always at the tail end for a bit at Nintendo? Like just just behind in
and
terms
I, well,
of
I,
what
I,
the new
I think
thing
it,
was?
Well, at this point nope, there had never been a generational shift like this, and nobody really knew. Like the NES was so popular and made so much money in foreign territories. Nobody really knew like the 8-bit business. Like, is it just going to keep going? You know, are we going to shift over into 16-bit smoothly? Is 16 and 8-bit going to sit on the shelves together? Like, what are we going to do? So you did see Nintendo putting in a lot of resources into continuing to develop 8-bit games, even as a Super Famicom was coming out, because there was no sense of this generational shift where, okay, we're going to wind this down, we're going to wind this up, and nobody really knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, 8-bit crashed and burned really fast.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I think if you look in kind of the wider spectrum, the most successful 8-bit systems lasted like 10 years. I mean, NES, Famicom, that was around for 11 years. The Spectrum in the UK was around forever
and
ever.
Well, the market fell out really quickly.
Yeah. But I don't think it was an immediate collapse. I think it was kind of a transition.
There was, if you look at you know, like business type magazines and things like that at the time, there was definitely a sense that people expected 8-bit to be strong for longer than it was.
Yeah. I think they were hedging their bets, but also I think it was basically all hands on deck. Like we finished Mario 3. Now we make Mario World and Zelda Link to the Past. Like all of our top guys are doing this for the next like 3 years. So
right.
like we're not going to see very much out of Nintendo itself outside of things like Takeda's division.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Makes you hope that's the story today with 3DS and Switch, but I digress.
It seems very much like R&D3 was I don't know what the metaphor is here, batting cleanup. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like they were just like engaged to deliver the things that were necessary that other people weren't doing. They were team players.
Yeah. It's like the team that's, you know, working on Hey Pikmin now. Like it's not glorious, but kids are going to buy it. It's going to make money for the company. So you got to suck it up and do it.
Someone's got to employ R-Zest. Not me.
R-Zest. Okay. So anyway, is there anything else really to be said about Takeda? Like I feel like talked about the most essential things here. But
so his last position on the passing away of Satoru Iwata, when Nintendo sort of were like, what are we going to do for leadership here? I mean, he was one of the two members of Nintendo that was elevated to the position of fellow, Miyamoto being creative fellow and Takeda being technology fellow
right.
to advise President Kimishima.
And acting director for a little bit, right? Didn't he and Miyamoto share that role?
Yeah, that triad kind of thing going on.
Yeah,
but Kimishima
shortly.
Was also there doing that stuff as well. Right?
Sure.
I mean, yeah.
I just hope we get a thorough hours-long interview with him because more than even Miyamoto, more than Tezuka, more than anyone could he tell you about the history of Nintendo. Like,
I mean he saw the company's transformation firsthand. He was there in the
– Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yes. I hope he talks and talks and talks. So we'll see.
Yeah, and he's, if anything, like, I mean, we did mention heavily influenced by Yokoi to the point that, like, followed the same philosophy, the same virtues of, like, hey, it's the application of the technology and not being on the bleeding edge of everything, mm-hmm. right? And to an extent, that lives on in Switch. That yeah. is very much yeah. still the case.
I mean, Wii was the first Nintendo home console to adopt the Gunpei Yokoi, you know, season technology concept.
But
that was always
forever.
Built into the handhelds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like the Wii was the first time that appeared in a home console and they said, you know what? Let's not compete with Sony, you know, blow to blow. Let's just do our own thing. And that was Takeda coming in and you know, he had a big part in shaping that direction and saying like, we don't have to go HD yet. We don't have to have the most technologically impressive system. We can do something that's going to be different and appealing and it'll be a success anyway. And yeah. they're right.
Yeah, and it impacted everything, right? I mean, it impacted the hardware sales for sure. It impacted the way the company was making games. I mean, they were trying very much to re-explain games to people because they got a whole new audience in there that they didn't expect and know necessarily how to talk to. Talk to us. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hopefully they will talk to us. Hopefully Takeda will talk to us and we'll learn lots of cool little tidbits about Nintendo now that he's no longer under corporate lock and key. Or
and I mean, it, you know, it, geez, like it's just nice. I'm trying to phrase this in the right way. It's nice to see people retire from Nintendo like before they're, I don't know, 80 years old because like as much as I like Nintendo, as much as I think Shigeru Miyamoto makes some pretty neat video games. The board of Nintendo right now, the youngest person on that board, I believe, is 44 years old. Whew. And the rest of it, you have this – I mean, and they – you know, anybody you talk to will tell you, oh, yeah, like, you know, anything Nintendo does, you got to get it past this board of directors. And they are some old men. Like
yes.
Miyamoto is a sprightly young 63.
Yeah.
Like on that board. So I mean to see people saying, you know what, I think I'll retire instead of staying here until I am dust.
Yeah. Takeda's only 68. So right. He made it out in his 60s.
He did. And so maybe get some new young blood in there. Maybe a guy who's in his 50s or something. Maybe somebody who just had his first grandkid can get in there and start literally making decisions as to like what Nintendo is gonna do with the video game.
I mean,
market.
We've seen what young like teams that. Can do at Nintendo, like Splatoon, like that is their invention and they trust
right.
them
that
and they made it hit.
Like the leader on that team though is not that young though, isn't he?
Right,
like in his 50s.
right.
But they call it like the young
but it's not
young
well it's
leader,
less about like we made a video game and more about like, you know, the making of big moves, you know, within the video game industry and like striking while the iron is hot and doing what's gonna, you know, be
well, that's
successful.
A completely separate issue. Striking while the iron is hot definitely seems to evade Nintendo constantly. But I do think that Switch is part of that too, right? That transition.
Yeah.
Younger people involved. Even for 1-2 Switch and all of its weirdness, like that was not made by old men. It was made by a younger guard. So hopefully we'll continue to see
you
that.
You need to make – it's like you – to be successful, it's like you need to make the radical changes before you have a huge bottoming out failure. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's tough to convince a company like Nintendo to – it's like you can get them to make radical change after they've like thoroughly face planted and everybody goes, okay, old ways aren't working. What's the new way? But it's like they couldn't have done the Switch coming off of the Wii.
The Wii U was
This extremely conservative thing that just did not. Yeah, exactly. So again.
But what a library it had.
New blood in there, hopefully. Yep.
All right. Well, I don't want to belabor the point. This is a quick and an efficient, tidy little episode. But I did want to sort of pay tribute to one of gaming's most enduring and I think in a lot of ways important designers.
That's
and
right.
I am looking forward to seeing someone who can step into Takeda's shoes. But I'm happy, as Chris said, that he is able to retire and hopefully enjoy many fruitful years of not working constantly at a corporation.
What do you do with yourself after 50 years of that? I don't know.
Probably like go on vacation.
Yeah, but then I mean,
the first time in two decades,
and a lot of people have ended up, you know, joining universities. And,
that's true.
And so I think that would be wonderful.
Yeah, and I mean, that way he's passing on his experience to a younger generation.
Yeah, I can see that
directly.
Happening.
That'd be great. So anyway, good luck, Mr. Takeda, et cetera, et cetera. Good luck, Nintendo. And Godspeed to all of us here at Retronauts. Anyway, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find Retronauts at Retronauts.com, on the iTunes Music Store, and on Podcast One's website and their app. You can also support us through Patreon, patreon.com/Retronauts. I think that's about it. Facebook, Twitter, yada, yada, yada. You know, the drill. Chris.
My Twitter handle is KobunHeat. That's KobunHeat. So come and tell me all the things I got wrong.
My Twitter handle is at Jose_Otero, and you can find me on IGN. And you can find Chris at Kotaku.
Kotaku.com.
There you go.
Yeah,
plug it.
Sure,
plug
why not?
I've never heard of this website. Oh, hi, I'm Bob. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. Every week is a new episode. We're going in order. At the time of this recording, we're towards the end of season 5. Who knows what will be when this launches, but just go to TalkingSimpsons.com or find Talking Simpsons in your podcast machine or app device or Victrola or something. I don't know.
Do you guys release on wax cylinders?
We're going to. That's going to be awesome. A Patreon tier. So look out for that. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Shake them Bart Simpsons like visage.
We got the Edison patent, so we're good.
Talking Simpsons by Thomas Edison.
And we're going to electrocute an elephant in every episode.
The entire thing just goes on. That's a bad idea.
All right. That is it for this episode. We'll be back on Monday with a full episode. Very exciting. Please look forward to it.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.